Welcome back to the Paramedic Practitioner Podcast. Today, I want to talk to you about reactive airway disease, specifically COPD and asthma. This is going to be a two-part series, and this is part one. Part two will be coming to you in a couple weeks. And I'm going to have my buddy Michael Perlmutter back on the show. He was on before when we did the SCAPE episode. He is a critical care paramedic, flight paramedic, and also a medical student. So he is going to be here for the second portion of this podcast to talk about our diagnosis and management of these diseases. To get started, I want to get into some of the pathophysiology and some of actually the home management of these patients. You have a better idea of what's actually going on in the pathophysiology realm for these, so you have a better understanding of these disease processes. So today, this podcast is primarily geared toward adults, but asthma is really a disease of younger people and children. So everything we say here, for the most part, is going to apply to children as well. And I'll be sure to clarify if there's anything that doesn't or anything that's really specific to kids. So the first thing I want to talk about is the terminology that we use when we talk about these diseases. So when we say COPD and asthma, we need to know exactly what those are referring to because there's really different underlying pathophysiology that goes into them. So when we say COPD, we're usually referring to emphysema and chronic bronchitis. And these diseases are most commonly caused by cigarette smoking, whereas emphysema can also rarely be caused by a genetic disease called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which does lead to an early onset of emphysema, especially if the patient is also a smoker. But emphysema is the breakdown of alveolar walls and dilation of the alveoli. So what you get is massive overinflated alveoli that are less compliant and have worse gas exchange. So they're not going to work as well. They're not going to inflate and collapse as well as normal lung tissue would. Chronic bronchitis, on the other hand, is just what it sounds like. The bronchi are chronically inflamed, which leads to buildup of mucus and inflammatory cells in the airways. The airways can also become thickened due to that inflammation, and that causes narrowing of the lumen. So chronic bronchitis is defined by a productive cough for at least 3 months, a year, over 2 years. That's a diagnosis typically made by a primary care physician. But that's what this patient, when someone tells you they have chronic bronchitis, that's what they're dealing with. They're dealing with is just chronic productive cough, and that's the most common presentation. But obviously, we see exacerbations of this disease process as well. The significant majority of patients that have COPD have both emphysema and chronic bronchitis. So they have this alveolar breakdown, and they also have inflammation of their airways and this buildup of excess mucus. The two disease processes do gradually get worse over time, but if the patient stops smoking, they typically have some improvement in their lung function, and you can see actually improvement on the cellular level as well. COPD patients are often on a combination of home medications, and we see these when we go to patients' houses. Which medications they take can clue us in to how severe their underlying disease is. As a rule, the more inhalers they have at home, the worse the disease is going to be. Their medications often include short-acting beta agonists, such as albuterol. This is really the first thing that a COPD patient's going to be put on. And then they might move to long-acting beta agonists, such as salmeterol or formoterol. And they also will move on to long-acting muscarinics, such as tiotropium, which is basically just a long-acting ipratropium bromide like we give in the field. Now, once they move into advanced disease and COPD, they're going to be put on inhaled corticosteroids, such as budesonide. The outpatient treatment of COPD is pretty standardized. So if you see patients who are on inhaled corticosteroids or have more meds than just your typical short-acting beta agonist, you can really assume that they have progressed kind of out of that mild to moderate disease and have gotten into more severe disease. Now, asthma is considered a separate disease entity than COPD usually. It's similar, it's kind of grouped in the same category, but it's really separate because the onset and the risk factors are completely different. Of course, patients can have both asthma and COPD, and there's a ton of overlap, so we have to consider that as well. The difference really is that asthma occurs in patients of all ages and is not simply related to smoking. Asthmatics have chronic airway inflammation, which leads to bronchoconstriction and increased airway resistance. There are several underlying factors that contribute to it, and we're really not sure specifically what causes it to develop, but it's likely related to a combination of genetic and environmental factors. There are a ton of possible triggers for exacerbation, as you're probably aware. Some patients have an allergic component where their asthma might flare up when they're exposed to potential allergens. And they might also have increased bronchoconstriction with things like exercise, cold or dry weather. Patients with exercise-induced asthma, really it's exactly what it sounds like. They have bronchoconstriction associated only when they exercise. Now, outpatient treatment of asthma is a little different than COPD. For mild cases, they're only going to get that short-acting beta agonist. But when we decide to escalate a patient with asthma, they're going to move up to an inhaled corticosteroid before we move to those long-acting beta agonist or long-acting muscarinics. We want to add that steroid first. So if you see a patient with those drugs at home, you can assume that they have a little bit more advanced asthma. Now, both COPD, really the bronchitis aspect, and asthma are obstructive lung diseases. What that means is that patients have difficulty exhaling. This is in contrast to restrictive lung diseases where patients have difficulty inhaling, and the common example there is pulmonary fibrosis. So normally, exhalation is a passive process because during inhalation, we've increased the pressure in the lungs, so it is more than atmospheric pressure. So air wants to leave the lungs to balance those pressures, so the air will leave passively. In an obstructive lung disease, the air does not freely leave the lungs because of decreased airway diameters and increased resistance to flow. So this means that residual lung volumes are larger in patients with obstructive lung disease because their exhalation times are longer and they don't fully exhale all the air. They require more effort to exhale. During an exacerbation, this leads to kind of a vicious cycle. As the airway diameters decrease, the patient needs to exhale harder, which generates a higher intrathoracic pressure. If you're pushing more air out, your intrathoracic pressure is rising. As the pressure in the chest cavity increases, it actually becomes higher than the pressure that's inside the airways, which leads to collapse of those airways during exhalation. That's called dynamic airway collapse. So you can imagine that the harder the patient works to exhale, the worse the airway obstruction will become because the intrathoracic pressure is going to be higher, which is going to further collapse those airways. This is the principle behind hearing wheezing, primarily during exhalation. The airways are narrower, which makes the air traveling through them move faster and more turbulent, which is why you hear the wheezing. These patients prefer long periods of exhalation to keep intrathoracic pressures low and keep the airways patent. But the instinct during an exacerbation is to breathe harder and faster, which worsens the problem. With these points, we can also explain why patients with obstructive lung disease purse their lips when they exhale. They're actually generating PEEP, which is positive end expiratory pressure. When patients exhale against a resistance, it increases the pressure within the airways, which makes them less likely to collapse as the intrathoracic pressure increases during exhalation. I'll talk more about this point later in relation to treatments. And it's also important to note that because exhalation is limited and CO2 is retained, patients with COPD and some with chronic asthma have chronically elevated CO2 levels, which can cause a respiratory acidosis. Okay, so now I want to get into diagnosis, recognition, treatment of these diseases. And for this, I have my buddy Michael Perlmutter, who I talked to you about earlier. We've heard him on the podcast before. So welcome, Mike.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
So let's first talk about recognizing these diseases in the pre-hospital setting. So who do we generally see with COPD versus asthma, and how do they present?
Yeah, so I think these can sometimes be difficult, but sometimes some basics of history taking from the patient or the family if they're there, and physical exam can be really important. I think one of them, although it's not perfect, is sometimes is age. I think it's less common to see asthma exacerbations in an older patient, whereas COPD might be more likely, either bronchitis or emphysema are more likely to be seen in an older patient. And also, as I said, I think the history and also just taking a look at what medications the patient is on can give you some big clues into what the underlying disease process is.
Yeah, I totally agree. Asthma is definitely going to be more of a disease of kids or younger adults, at least the onset will be. And then obviously they can still have exacerbations later in life. But then the COPDers are mostly going to be older people who have been smoking for a long time, and they've just kind of developed the disease later in life. And that's going to be probably the most common time we see obstructive airway disease. It's going to be usually COPD patients. So what do these patients look like when we're walking in the door? Let's say it's a moderate to severe exacerbation. What are they going to be looking like when they first walk in the door?
Yeah, so I think there's a big range of presentation. And as you see more and more of them, you get a sense of what kind of moderately sick, really sick, and almost about to keel over and die sick looks like. You know, the biggest thing that jumps to mind, as you were saying, you know, what do they look like coming in the door? The first thing that jumped to my mind was the patients in tripod position. So they'll kind of be leaning forward, have their hands on their knees, something like that, like trying as hard as they can to maximize chest expansion and get air in. The other, I think, is the use of accessory muscles. So they're, you know, pulling every intercostal muscle that they can to try to get a breath. They can't speak in full sentences. You know, you'll get out one or two words at a time. Sometimes breathing really, really fast, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 breaths a minute, just kind of these quick little gasps of breath. And the other clue, I think, that sometimes gets missed is tachycardia. So you might not see that extreme elevation in respiratory rate, but a patient who's in severe respiratory distress is often going to have a heart rate in the 120s, 130s, 140s, things like that. And I've even seen tachycardia in the 150s, 160s, 170s, even mistaken for SVT, and people kind of get fixated on the heart rate and don't realize that it's a symptom of severe respiratory distress or hypoxia that the patient's trying to compensate for. So I think those are some big clues coming in the door. You know, this, I think, is a tough one, too, because sometimes you can hear the wheezing from across the room and it kind of, the diagnosis kind of gives itself away or at least pushes you toward asthma or COPD. But I think it can kind of fool you where on the other end or the sort of the far, far end of the spectrum is the silent chest where they're moving so little air that you're not hearing wheezing, you're not hearing ronchi, you're not hearing air move at all. But it can be kind of falsely reassuring. Especially with asthma, you can have a high pulse oximetry reading, even though the patient is kind of perimortem, almost on the verge of respiratory failure.
Those are some awesome points. We talked earlier about the reason why, you know, these patients get obstruction and how, you know, that increased respiratory rate and how they're working harder to breathe and exhale isn't actually doing them any good, because as that obstruction gets worse and they start to, you know, exhale harder, they're actually just collapsing their airways more. And then as they increase their respiratory rate, they're just increasing the lung volume that they can then not exhale. So really, this is that vicious cycle that I mentioned earlier in the podcast, where patients are just trying to work harder to breathe, but it doesn't really benefit them at all. It's just going to make the exacerbation a lot worse. So I want to get into a little bit about what tools are actually useful in diagnosing this disease and kind of differentiating it. I mean, one of the big things we have to do is differentiate COPD from CHF. And a lot of times our patients have both diseases at baseline, or maybe you think there's a new onset of one of these diseases in a patient with a bunch of underlying factors that could contribute to both. So we have to really decide what's going on and let that kind of drive our care, because obviously the care plans are quite different between COPD and CHF. So I think the first thing we generally think about is auscultation, and that's obviously going to be one of the most important aspects of assessing a patient with COPD, and then or asthma, obviously, but mostly we're talking about COPD because these are typically older patients where the diagnosis is less clear. So generally, I'd say lung sounds are pretty unreliable, and if you don't hear an abnormal sound, it doesn't necessarily mean there's nothing going on. It just means you didn't hear it or it wasn't, you know, audible to you. And the other thing is that when they studied auscultation and they looked at, you know, agreement between providers on lung sounds, there's really very poor agreement. So two people listening to the same patient could interpret those sounds very differently. So I think auscultation is obviously important to do, but we can't always rely on it as a definitive diagnostic tool.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think especially that older patient population that you were talking about, differentiating COPD from CHF or acute pulmonary edema can be really challenging. One of the things that I've noticed the most that tends to confound people is that the work of breathing that comes with a COPD exacerbation, especially a severe one, is that the patient can become fairly significantly hypertensive. So you can see blood pressures of 170, 180, 190. I've seen blood pressures as high as 200 in COPD exacerbations where the patient does not have any underlying heart failure and does not have any underlying pulmonary fluid. But the providers get fooled into thinking that it's a CHF exacerbation. They go down that pathway. So I totally agree. And I think that you're right. The data of supporting auscultation as a diagnostic method is not the best, which, you know, I think leads to our favorite topic of conversation, which is ultrasound. And I think point of care ultrasound makes a huge difference in the ability to differentiate CHF and COPD. But the other thing I would say is just kind of coming back to the basic stuff that you can gather up if you don't have ultrasound is just, again, what is the patient history? What are the medications that you find on scene? Because I think it's quite unlikely, possible, but quite unlikely that an elderly patient is going to have a sudden onset of heart failure that leads to, you know, significant pulmonary edema with no past history of heart disease, no past history of heart failure, no beta blockers, no ACE inhibitors, no diuretics, no nothing in the house, you know. So I think using some of that stuff can help you differentiate as well, either if you don't have ultrasound or while you're getting the ultrasound set up, that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like you said, the meds and the history are going to be key in making your diagnosis and kind of trying to decide what the most likely thing to be going on here is. And you mentioned before about the patients with silent chest and how we should not be falsely reassured by a lack of wheezing or a lack of any sounds in a patient with respiratory distress, because if you're not hearing anything and someone looks to be working pretty hard, that probably means that their airways are so tight that they're just not wheezing anymore. So, you know, we really shouldn't be falsely reassured just because we're not hearing that wheezing. Wheezing will get worse as the patient gets sicker, but then it'll often just go away, and that's a sign of deterioration or potential decompensation. And then talking about ronchi, we hear ronchi in a lot of our COPD patients as well, and that's because they all have, or most of them have, a chronic bronchitis, which causes that mucus to build up in the larger airway. So ronchi is just caused by mucus and junk in the airways. It's not as much about the airway constriction as we think about with wheezing, but it can be indicative of some potential airway disease, and it might be helped by bronchodilators, but it's not helped as much as wheezing because it's not really due to the airway constriction, it's just due to the mucus. So those bronchodilators might help to thin secretions, but they're not really going to treat the underlying cause of the ronchi. And the next thing I want to bring up is capnography. So capnography is pretty useful in diagnosing obstruction. How do you use it, Mike, in your practice?
Yeah, I think our use of it is really expanded. And it's funny you say it because it's almost become so routine for us that it's not as remarkable, right? It doesn't immediately jump out because it's become almost like pulse oximetry. Like, yeah, of course we use capnography, but we use the end-tidal CO2 cannula that goes on just like a nasal cannula. And you can deliver a little bit of oxygen with that. It's essentially just blow by oxygen. But for us, it's a really nice tool because one, you can get a sense of perhaps how bad the exacerbation is just by looking at what the CO2 level is, but also I think more importantly by reading the waveform. So if you see an obstructive waveform versus a restrictive waveform on the capnogram, that really can point you down a path toward treating appropriately. So I think it's a hugely important tool.
Any patient that I have in respiratory distress, I put them on a cannula right away. And then the point you made about the blow by oxygen, I think, is important. Many people might not know. Most of those end-tidal CO2 cannulas can't actually deliver a lot of oxygen. There's no oxygen that actually comes out of the nasal prongs. There's little holes that are on the cannula tubing itself that kind of basically deliver blow by, and they're only good up to about 5 liters a minute max, and it's still not great. So you don't want to rely on those cannulas for oxygen delivery. And then you mentioned the obstructive pattern, which is really what we're looking for here. It can help us distinguish what's going on, whether it is truly an obstructive disease that's causing the respiratory distress. And it can, like you said, help determine the severity. So if we see a really obstructive pattern, what this is going to look like is the upstroke of the during exhalation, the upstroke is going to be prolonged. It's not going to be that nice square that we usually see in a normal waveform. It's going to be prolonged. And those complexes, those exhalation waveforms might go for a long period of time as the patient exhales. So that's a good sign that you're dealing with an obstructive pathology. And then also, like you said, if we have high CO2 values, that can indicate potentially a worse underlying respiratory acidosis. As we mentioned before, patients with chronic obstructive diseases often have a chronic respiratory acidosis. So But in an acute exacerbation, you're going to get a buildup of CO2. So the higher that CO2 number is, the more they're probably retaining. So those are some good indicators on this, on the end-tidal CO2 of what's going on kind of at a pathophysiologic level. The next thing, so you brought up ultrasound already, which is a really important point. And I think it's a tool that's really kind of growing in popularity. It's not everywhere yet, but I do think pretty soon ultrasound is going to be commonplace for paramedics. The main reason to use ultrasound in this setting is to rule in or rule out the presence of pulmonary edema. If we don't see it and we're thinking COPD, then it's probably COPD. If we are thinking COPD and we see pulmonary edema on our ultrasound, we're going to be thinking of going down a different treatment route than we were before. So what we're looking for really, without getting into too much detail, is the presence or absence of B lines. If you see what are known as B lines, that indicates pulmonary edema. And I think lung ultrasound is probably the most valuable use of ultrasound in the field, just because it is incredibly easy to use and pretty easy to interpret for the two main indications, which is presence of pulmonary edema or presence of a pneumothorax. Those two things we can use lung ultrasound for pretty easily with fairly minimal training. It's a pretty easy exam to perform. So I think it's a really useful ultrasound exam to do in the field. And the other thing about pneumothorax too, is that's another thing we need to be considering in our patients with asthma. Once they get really hyperinflated, they can actually develop pneumothorax or pneumothoraces as well as our COPD patients. So we need to be considering that in all those patients. And it can be pretty difficult to rule in or rule out a pneumothorax in patients that could potentially just have a silent lung, or they might have a pneumo. So ultrasound is pretty useful there, I would say, too.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because I think that the sensitivity of ultrasound for specifically for pneumothorax is really very good. In fact, better than chest x-ray in many cases. And I think you're right on the money that differentiating pneumothorax from silent chest or other pathology in these kinds of airway diseases really, really challenging. So I think ultrasound can be a very powerful tool in making that choice.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So when you're looking at an asthma or COPD exacerbation, what things are you looking for to kind of determine how severe the exacerbation is and how aggressive you need to be with your care? What are you looking for in your patients?
You know, I think this is a tough one because I think a lot of it boils down to gestalt. But for me, one of the most important questions I ask a patient who appears to be in significant distress is, you know, how does this rank compared to your worst attack? Is this the worst it's ever been? Is this not as bad as it's been? And often I think patients have been down this road before and can kind of give you a hint about how bad this is. Is this, I'm about to be intubated. I've the last time I was this bad, I ended up in the ICU for a week. Or is this kind of a, you know, I called you because I felt like it was going that direction, but we're not there yet. The other big thing to me is just the, you know, the so-called death stare. I think when patients are in such severe distress that they're just staring straight ahead, everything they have is focused on getting that next breath, trying as hard as they can to get more air. I think those are two fairly reliable ways of getting a sense pretty quickly of where you're at. I think the other thing, it kind of alludes back to what I was saying before, is pulse oximetry can be a powerful tool. I think if the pulse ox is dipping, you're in a dangerous space because now they've really failed to compensate. Because I think the thing to realize with these diseases in large part is that it's not a matter of getting air in, it's a matter of getting air out. So even in severe cases, the pulse oximetry can be falsely reassuring. You can have a pulse ox of 100%, even though the patient is on the verge of respiratory failure and respiratory arrest. So just having an awareness that that's the case and not being kind of lulled into a false sense of security by that, and just looking, you know, is their mentation intact? Can they speak in more than one or two words if all they can say is can't breathe? I think you have to be very, very worried at that point.
Yeah, I totally agree. A lot of this just comes down to how they look and what they say about the exacerbation. Is it worse than usual? Is it, you know, not as bad? I called earlier this time because last time it didn't go so well. So that's definitely a good sign, good things to look for. And then just objectively, things you can be looking at are respiratory rate. Like you mentioned, oxygen saturation is huge. These patients aren't usually terribly hypoxic in the early stages, but if they're starting to drop their sats, that's an indicator that things are probably deteriorating. And then worker breathing, accessory muscle use, you mentioned that earlier, retractions. Those are things that you can see in adults, but in kids, they're great indicators of worsening respiratory status. And then we do see mental status changes in these patients, and that's usually caused by a combination of things, but typically respiratory fatigue, and then also you get CO2 retention, which can cause a hypercapnic encephalopathy. So basically they get altered just because of all that CO2 that's building up. So that's why you start to see deterioration. In either of those cases, the patient's way decompensated and they're not handling the disease and they need a pretty prompt intervention.
It reminded me just now of, I think, one of the worst cases I've ever seen, and this was a number of years ago, and it was the middle of the night. And the funny thing is that the call came out as agitation, and we encountered a young person in the parking lot of a store very late at night, and there was concern for drug overdose or mental health crisis, things like that, because the patient was just completely irrational and delirious. And it wasn't until we got this person into the truck and started investigating a little bit further that we realized that he was very, very, very close to respiratory failure because of severe asthma. So I think your point about mental status is really well taken, that if you have a patient who's sort of inexplicably agitated, one thing to consider might be that they're in the end stage of respiratory distress, about to go into respiratory failure. And I think it also ties into a point you made earlier about end-tidal CO2, which is even if you start out a case where the patient may be in moderate distress, but you have that end-tidal CO2 cannula on and you're watching the CO2 kind of steadily creep up and up and up and up as the mental status goes down, 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 I think that's a pretty good indicator that you need to escalate your treatment strategy because the degree of respiratory distress is getting worse, not better.
Yeah, that's a great point about the worsening CO2 and how you can kind of trend that on the end title. And then just a little sidebar, you mentioned altered mental status and how that can really just be a different critical illness that you're not really expecting, kind of just caught being manifest as altered mental status. So it really speaks to aggressive treatment of patients that are agitated and trying to get them sedated so you can evaluate them and figure out if there's something else going on. And that could be, you know, maybe they've got a respiratory thing going on or they've got some other metabolic issue that's making them agitated. It might not just be a psychiatric problem.
Absolutely.
So one thing I actually wanted to bring up first is that there's one significant differential on the table for kids, mostly, that are seemingly having an asthma exacerbation, and that is vocal cord dysfunction. So kids, we're actually recognizing more frequently now that kids get what's called vocal cord dysfunction. But this can cause respiratory distress that looks a lot like asthma. They actually get stridor, but it can sound like wheezing. So asthma in kids can be diagnosed in patients that actually have vocal cord dysfunction. So just something to be aware of. There's not a lot we can do in the field to really confirm this diagnosis, but it's something to be concerned about if you are treating an asthmatic that's really not getting any better. They're just kind of staying the same. It might not be asthma, just something to kind of consider. So to get into treatment of these patients, so the first thing I like to think about in any of these respiratory patients is positioning. And I talked a lot about positioning in the airway podcast I did a little while back. A lot of times they will position themselves when you get there. And like you mentioned, Mike, they tripod to kind of open up the thoracic cavity, get more air in, you know, get their airflow maximized. Sometimes they're not perfectly positioned as we would like them to be. So what we want to do is shoot for an upright position. We want to get them as upright as possible. And on the stretcher, that means as close to 90 degrees as possible. So sit the stretcher right up. And what that's going to do is increase the thoracic cavity volume and move the abdominal contents away from the diaphragm so that they can really fully expand their diaphragm to not limit their respiratory function. So then the next thing we usually think about, and on a national registry test, you always have to think about giving oxygen. But Mike, when are we actually going to be giving supplemental oxygen to these patients?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I think, you know, you brought up the national registry, and I think the conventional wisdom is to just throw the oxygen on anybody with respiratory distress. And I would argue that these patients may not benefit from supplemental oxygen except as a delivery tool for nebulized beta-2 agonists and agents like ipratropium or tiotropium. I think if you can titrate the oxygen, that's a good thing. I think if you're heading down a path of sort of inevitability of advanced airway management, then I probably have a lower threshold to throw on high flow oxygen just to buy me as much safe apnea time as possible. If I'm going to be forced into a situation that requires apnea like RSI, if I don't have DSI or I don't have an awake intubation approach available to me, then I might have a lower threshold. But otherwise, I don't think that there's necessarily a benefit to throwing high flow oxygen at these people. That said, I'll just put in a plug for a pet peeve, which is that I think that the sort of conventional or perhaps old school teaching at this point that you can't put more than 2 liters of oxygen on a COPD patient is absolute nonsense. If their 2 liters was doing the job, then they wouldn't have called 911. So I think you can kind of dispense with that. But I'm curious how that matches into your sort of framework for treating people too.
Oh yeah, I very rarely put supplemental oxygen on anyone. In these patients, I'm happy with, like in an asthmatic, I'm pretty happy with sats as low as 90% or so. And then in COPD, I'll go down as low as 87, 88 without really applying supplemental oxygen. But like you said, we're going to be giving some supplemental oxygen anyway if we're delivering nebulizers. So it doesn't really, it's not going to help as much to put the cannula on. They're going to be getting 6 to 8 liters through the nebulizer anyway. So, you know, I'm not jumping to throw an NRB or a cannula on these patients right away. If they start to deteriorate and really get hypoxemic, then certainly I'll throw some more supplemental oxygen on, but it's mostly going to just be whatever I give through the nebulizer.
I think it's an interesting point too, to get into the nuance of delivering nebulized meds. I sometimes wonder if the ambulance of the future, if medical air will be more common than it is now, because I think, as you said, certainly my practice as well has shifted very much away from supplemental oxygen. I also give it exceedingly rarely. And if I had the choice, I think for the vast majority of these patients, I would prefer to deliver albuterol or Atrovent or whatever else with medical air versus with pure oxygen, because I think most of these patients just don't need it. And I think, you know, even more so, it's sort of a thing that I didn't think about quite as much in the past, but I think there is something serious to be said about free radical damage to tissues that are already, you know, kind of hyper-inflamed in the case of asthma and COPD, that I don't think we're doing patients any favors by contributing to that with these super high flow deliveries of oxygen. So maybe we'll see that change in the future.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the more evidence that comes out, the more damage it seems the unnecessary oxygen seems to do. So yeah, I think just reducing it and titrate it to a reasonable oxygen saturation, and don't use, you know, unnecessary oxygen. So the next thing also I wanted to bring up is IV fluids in these patients. So I think that there's not a lot of patients that we see that actually really need IV fluids, but a lot of these patients with severe respiratory distress can actually be quite volume depleted just due to respiratory losses. If they've been struggling to breathe for a long period of time, they can be pretty fluid down, and that might manifest as excess tachycardia. You might see them be hypotensive, even if they're later in the disease process. So these are patients that I like to give a bolus of ideally lactated ringers to, just to kind of restore that fluid volume that's lost. And that's especially true if I'm going to be doing any kind of advanced airway management, which we'll get into a little bit later on. But yeah, I'm usually giving these patients some sort of IV fluids.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And that's a peeve that drives me off the wall, at least where I am a fairly rare case, that I tend to give these patients a lot of fluid. And I get a lot of confused looks, particularly when the patients are not hypotensive or not particularly tachycardic. But I think your point is excellent. These patients lose so much fluid by insensible losses.
Yeah, if they're really sick, or especially if you're seeing signs of volume depletion, I wouldn't hesitate to give a fairly decent bolus. And one thing to obviously to remember is make sure you've ruled out pulmonary edema before you start loading up patients with fluid, because they don't need any more fluid. So yeah, just make sure you're treating the right thing before you're starting to give IV fluids. Let's talk about nebulizers a little bit. So obviously albuterol is typically our primary agent we're going to go to. And it's a beta 2 agonist, sympathomimetic, and it works by stimulating beta 2 receptors in the airway, which are the primary sympathetic nervous system components in the airway. And we know that when the sympathetic system activates, beta 2 receptors get stimulated and the airway muscles relax and increase in diameter. So we think about this from a fight or flight perspective. We need to increase respiratory capacity to respond to a threat. So that's why we see why we can kind of take advantage of the sympathetic nervous system in this case. How do you usually like to deliver your nebs, Mike? Do you have a particular way to give them?
So I use a breath-actuated nebulizer device, which I like because it delivers a much higher percentage of medication to the patient. You don't lose nearly so much to the environment. So when the patient takes a breath, they get a hit of whatever medication you're nebulizing that goes straight into the lungs. So I prefer it that way, kind of pertaining to our previous discussion about oxygen. I run the oxygen generally as low as the nebulizer manufacturer guidelines will let me. So if the range is, you know, 6 to 10, I run it at 6 unless I have a reason not to. I also tend to think that in a moderate to severe, especially in a severe, but in moderate cases too, I think the typical 2.5 milligrams of albuterol is a fine place to start, but you might as well give more rather than less. So, you know, you have to go by protocol and what your standing orders are. But given the choice, I would generally give 5. And if it's a severe case that looks like it could be heading toward respiratory failure, I give it continuously. So if that's 5, 10, 15, 20 milligrams, I don't really start paying attention to the whole dose until I'm up at least 15 or 20. Unless there's significant tachycardia or sort of concerning side effects. But I think my general theory with albuterol is give more, give more, give more until you feel like you know, kind of have a foothold and you're coming out from behind the eight ball and you've got some control over the situation.
There's rarely a downside to just kind of starting a continuous albuterol neb in these really sick asthmatics. And then if they're pretty mild and you're thinking you might just be able to turn them around, maybe they're not even in distress, they just feel a little wheezy, maybe, you know, one dose at a time. But if they're struggling to breathe at all, I'm usually going to just be running my nebulizers fairly continuously. And what you said about the breath actuated neb is important. I think the typical kind of T piece really loses a lot of medication. And if you can use a breath actuated device, that's great. The other thing, I typically will just use a mask for almost every patient because that's going to deliver more medication as well. And it allows you to kind of have both arms free. I typically hate having to have the patient hold a nebulizer the whole time. So I'll put a mask on them. It makes it easier to deliver the medication as long as, you know, it's a fairly open mask so they're not being suffocated or anything, like with a non-rebreather mask that's set too low. So I like to just put it on a mask and make it my life a little bit easier. The other thing, the next drug we usually give with albuterol is ipratropium, and that's usually referred to as a duo-neb. And we know ipratropium is a parasympatholytic, which blocks the parasympathetic nervous system. It blocks acetylcholine receptors in the lungs. So the acetylcholine is the primary neurotransmitter of the parasympathetic nervous system. So if we block it, we can antagonize that nervous system. And what that does, just like our albuterol, it's relaxing the airway muscles. It's also going to help us decrease mucus secretion. So those two drugs working in kind of in concert with each other with different mechanisms allows us to get some bronchodilation. That's why we give them together. They're both working toward the same effect. And there's a common misconception that you can only give a maximum dose of ipratropium, but really there's not so much a max. There's minimal adverse effects. If you did start to see anticholinergic effects from it, you could stop. So I'll usually just keep ipratropium going in with my albuterol on a continuous nebulizer if the patient's looking sick.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think there's little downside. And the other thing to realize too, which I was never taught in paramedic school, but there's a long-acting form of ipratropium, the tiotropium. So, you know, there are patients walking around all the time who are chronically on these muscarinic antagonists and do just fine. So I think, again, if you have a very sick patient, in my mind, the benefits outweigh the risks. I think that's an excellent point.
So now let's talk a little bit about steroids. So in the pre-hospital setting, I think that pretty much any patient with wheezing or distress due to COPD or asthma should get a dose of steroids from EMS. That's mostly because we know that early steroid administration can improve outcomes, reduces hospital admissions, things like that. It's one of the things we do. It actually has quite a bit of evidence behind it. But we do have to realize that steroids are not helpful acutely. You're not going to give a steroid in the ambulance and see the effects there. The goal of the steroid is to reduce long-term effects, reduce long-term inflammation, hopefully prevent relapse and shorten the exacerbation. I know there's definitely a lot of controversy out there about what steroid to use and what route. Do you have any opinions on that?
I don't. As far as I'm aware, the evidence isn't super clear to indicate one or the other, but I think the biggest takeaway is the one that you made, which is that you should not give this expecting to see an immediate result. I think of it as, you know, starting to move the ball down the field, but it's the ED or the inpatient team that's going to see the benefit, not in EMS, unless you are in an EMS system that has, you know, transport times of over an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. It's one of those things that does have a large benefit for the patient, but it's not a benefit that you're likely to see in transport.
Yeah, definitely. It's just one of those things we do to help the patient long-term. It's very important. It's probably very underutilized. I see a lot of people just not giving it, especially if they see a patient that's not in a lot of distress. They should still be getting a steroid, even if they're having an acute exacerbation that's kind of above and beyond their home medication. That's the indication for them to get a steroid dose from us. And as far as this specific drug, you're right, the evidence is pretty boring on that topic. We usually use methylprednisolone or dexamethasone, and they're both probably fine. I think dexamethasone is becoming more popular, and it's definitely the choice in children usually. And the important thing, I think a shift that we can make in EMS is that we know that oral steroids are just as effective as IV steroids. There's really no huge benefit to giving IV steroids, and it might actually cause potentially more adverse effects from getting an IV steroid over an oral steroid. So if your patient can tolerate it, you can consider giving your IV dexamethasone orally. You can give the same solution orally. Or if your system's progressive, you could start carrying oral prednisone instead of giving your IV steroids to every patient with an exacerbation. That seems like a good place to end part one. Part two will come within the next couple weeks, where we get into some more advanced treatments of asthma and start talking about our sicker patients. Thank you for listening to the Paramedic Practitioner Podcast. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can also get me on Twitter at amerlman and email amerlman@gmail.com. Also, be sure to check out our sponsor, Prodigy EMS, for your learning management system needs. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.